This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 17th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums. KUIF is supported by Soul Yoga Lounge, located on Dixon Street in front of Clubhouse Fitness in Fayetteville. Hot yoga is available to the community each Friday afternoon at 5:45. All skill levels are welcome. SoulYogaLounge.com for more information. Ahead on Ozarks, a local group is thinking globally. The Global Orphan Initiative wants to create ways for corporations to help the orphan children of the world. We'll have a conversation with the executive director of the project. Plus, the week's business news in Arkansas, the role of pirates in the colonization of the Americas, and more. First, more than 40 Democratic former heads of state and government members are gathering at the Clinton Presidential Center in Little Rock today for the annual Club de Madrid Conference. It's known as the world's largest forum of former Democratic heads of state. Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe says the state's positive reputation has grown in recent months by hosting foreign dignitaries through the U.S. State Department's Experience America program, as well as this week's Club de Madrid Conference.
Meetings like this usually happen in larger cities like New York or Chicago. The fact that Little Rock was able to attract back-to-back meetings of this caliber is no small feat. While the Clintons' influence certainly factored into locating the meetings here, Arkansas was selected in the end because it is increasingly viewed as a favorable destination. We hope that these visitors from Club de Madrid will leave Little Rock as unofficial ambassadors of our state, telling others around the world about their experiences here.
The Club de Madrid conference continues through tomorrow. In recognition of the shooting that took place Friday in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama has ordered all U.S. and Arkansas flags to be flown at half-mast in honor of the victims of that shooting. Flags will remain lowered until sundown tomorrow. Following that shooting, several school leaders across the country have issued statements detailing safety and lockdown procedures in place at school campuses. Yesterday, Fayetteville School Superintendent Vicki Thomas issued a release detailing the security procedures in place across the Fayetteville School District. According to that release, each campus has a lockdown and evacuation plan specifically designed for that campus, and all staff members and police have copies of the evacuation plans. Additionally, all school visitors are required to sign in through the main office of the school, and security cameras are present in all buildings on campus. Thomas also says in the release that counselors are available on each campus to help students cope with the news of the recent shooting in Connecticut, and the school district has requested additional police patrols and visibility throughout the school this week. Thomas says one of the most important things the district can do is maintain a normal routine on a daily basis, as routine establishes a strong sense of safety and security. Benton County residents who voted in the June 19th millage election for Bentonville Public Schools will soon get a survey in the mail from the district. The district announced this morning that surveys have been mailed to those who voted in the June election. The flash surveys are designed to help the school board chart a course for the next millage election that would fund construction of expansions to the district's high school. Before the school board can design a growth plan for the high school, district officials want to gauge public support for a variety of options. District officials said that another millage election will likely happen next fall. Over 655 million packages and cards are projected to be mailed by the end of the day today, the busiest delivery day of the year. Post office officials are urging Arkansans to deliver their packages sooner rather than later, after seeing a 20% increase in package delivery last year. Because of the popularity of online shopping, officials predict record-breaking numbers for 2012. A spokesperson for the post office, Lisa Tolliver-Gay, says to check the USPS website for ways to make mailing packages easier.
You can schedule a pickup. You can print and your labels and your postage. If you're using click and ship, you can even order stamps online. And if you're going out of town, you can even put your mail on hold online.
Post offices will operate under revised hours during the holiday season and will resume regular business hours Wednesday, January 2nd. If you've walked around the downtown Fayetteville Square at any time in spring, summer, or fall months, you likely have noticed the carefully manicured gardens that surround the square, and you may have noticed the electrical boxes that spring up from the ground in the middle of those gardens. There is now an effort to conceal the boxes. City horticulturist Roxanne Worthy says City Parks and Recreations Department is commissioning local artist Jason Jones to paint the utility boxes to make them less prominent in the gardens. Worthy says Jones has volunteered in the past with the Kid Crops Garden at the Yvonne Richardson Community Center.
He painted a really cute sign for us at the Kids Crop Garden, and then we've seen some of his other works, including the poster he did for Block Street last year. And so I just asked him, would he want to come up with a few ideas? And he came up with using beneficial insects, which he felt would blend well into the garden and be educational at the same time.
Fayetteville isn't the first city to attempt to disguise its utility boxes in public places. Cities such as San Diego, Vail, and Topeka have taken similar measures to hide the metal utility boxes. Worthy says, although the boxes to be painted are in the middle of a garden, little can be done in the way of plant cover to conceal them.
Because a lot of them have underground wires, and we might be able to put a ground cover on underneath the box, but it's really hard to put a bigger plant in front of them. Now, we have on one side, but the plants haven't grown big enough to hide it. So in the wintertime, the boxes just kind of jump out at you.
The city's project will cost about $850. Worthy says she's hopeful to have the project complete by the time spring arrives. And if warmer temperatures allow, Jones could begin painting the utility boxes as soon as the lights of the Ozarks come down after the first of the year. Walton Arts Center is adding Mary Chapin Carpenter and Sean Colvin to the 2013 entertainment calendar. The two Grammy winners will share the stage Saturday, March 2nd. The tickets will go on sale Wednesday. The University of Arkansas women's basketball team now 9-1 after defeating Furman 73-39 in South Carolina yesterday. Freshman Melissa Wolf led the Razorbacks with a career-high 15 points. Arkansas will host Mississippi Valley State in Bud Walton Arena Wednesday night. Clear tonight, lows in the mid-30s. Clear tomorrow, highs in the lower to mid-60s. And for Tuesday night, clear in the evening, then partly cloudy with lows in the lower 40s. This is Ozarks at Large. This weekend, there was much conversation, nationally certainly, and likely for you personally as well, about the sometimes overwhelming task of trying to make the world better and safer. A new project based in Northwest Arkansas is trying to work toward solutions in what can be a rather intimidating challenge, helping the planet's millions of orphan children. Matt Pfeiffer came to Arkansas to work for Walmart and has since become a partner in 101 Ventures here. He's also the executive director of Global Orphan Initiative, an endeavor he hopes will link corporations to efforts to create better lives for children around the world. Recently, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and told me that the initiative was inspired by his family's personal experiences.
My wife and I, very early in our marriage, began to look at adoption and international adoption more specifically as a way to grow our family. And we didn't end up doing so then. But when I worked for Walmart, had a great career with Walmart, had an opportunity to work abroad, lived in Tokyo for almost 2 years. And while I was living in Tokyo, had an opportunity to go and visit China. And while in China, just saw some things that just horrified me. And we made a decision right after returning from that trip that that we were going to figure out a way to adopt a child. And so as soon as we finished that expat assignment in 2004, my wife and I started the process and adopted a little girl. And it took quite a while. It was 2006 by the time we got her home. And it's just been such a great experience for our entire family. And from that point forward, we thought, well, gosh, you know, there's got to be more to it than this. Are we supposed to adopt another child? Are we supposed to work with other families and help, you know, those that are interested in doing the same thing that we've done kind of follow suit? And then found out that some really good friends of ours, the Morris family, he's a Bentonville police officer. They've been married for 20 years. And in their 20 years, they've been able to foster more than 100 different children. It's an amazing story. And speaking with Mark told us that their intention early next year, actually as soon as school gets out, so early summer, they're planning to sell everything that they own and move permanently to Ecuador to start an orphanage there. I mean, there's more than 200,000 orphans in Ecuador, and you know, most of these orphanages are privately run. They're terribly underfunded. And so in having a conversation with Mark, decided, gosh, there's a great opportunity. You know, by then, we had already kind of established ourselves in the business community, and we're doing lots of things with you know, some of the major businesses that have a presence here. And we thought, goodness, there's an opportunity for us to leverage the connectivity that we have in the business community to not just help support the work of the Morrises in Ecuador, but provide a means of funding some of the other orphanages, the incredibly underfunded orphanages that are in that country.
The idea behind Global Orphan Initiative is eventually to help orphanages in many countries.
That's right. That's our hope. And we want to start not small, but certainly very focused. And so, you know, one of the ideas we had early on was, you know, let's just start looking for orphan care facilities in various countries that are underfunded and for whatever reason they're under capacity because they don't have the budget, or they've got facilities that are in a dilapidated state because they can't keep up with them, or they've got a vision to open other facilities in other cities. And so we thought about, you know, do we focus on projects or do we focus a country at a time? And I think where we're at now is, you know, the Morris family has really got a desire to invest, you know, really to go all in Ecuador. And so we've already identified 8 orphanages in the country where we're gonna get involved in a handful of projects starting next year.
Do you have any idea how many people there are like the Morrises?
I think there's a lot out there. I mean, the reality is most of these orphanages, there's an awful lot that are out there that are state-run, but there's a lot of people. You know, we met a family just a couple weeks ago that are, they're Canadians that back in the 1990s moved themselves to Ecuador. There's a lot of families that for whatever reason have decided to pack up all that they own and go all in. You know, a lot of it has to do with just a love for children. A lot of people just feel like they've been blessed themselves and have a need to go and serve.
I'm not asking you to speak for them, but is it difficult? I mean, it's one thing to say you want to do this, but to pack up and go to a different country that might have different rules or regulations.
Sure. I think there's certain countries that are definitely more friendly than others. I think the Morris's experience so far has been very good. You know, they are certainly not the first foreign family to do this, and so the government already has relationships with families from other countries that have decided for no personal gain to themselves to go in and invest in trying to help not solve this problem, but certainly help take care of a children that they're unable to take care of themselves.
You're going to focus a lot on corporate America.
Yes. I think that, you know, for a long time, families like ours have been fairly faithful contributors to some great organizations like World Vision, et cetera, you know, UNICEF and others. There's some great organizations out there, and they rely heavily upon either government funding or, you know, individual contributions. And what we recognize is that corporate America is able to, in the United States, is able to export about $1.5 trillion worth of goods and services every single year. And certainly those countries benefit from reciprocal trade, but there's so much opportunity there to take care of a growing orphan population. And so what we have done with Global Orphan Initiative is to create a means by which corporate America can invest in the markets where they're doing business, either where they're buying or selling products and services or otherwise doing business. So that's our focus. I mean, we are not going to turn away individual contributions. If anybody, you know, wanted to join us and make a donation, I think that'd be wonderful, but we're not going to be soliciting those donations. Really, our focus is going to be on major American corporations.
Any idea how many orphans there are in the world?
Yeah, there's about 143 million, and that's conservative. That's based on a UNICEF figure, and that's pretty conservative. Every year, 14 million of these children are going to be of these orphans are going to age out of the system. So they get to a point where they're too old to stay in an orphanage, and so a lot of these kids are going to end up going, you know, into the streets. And there's all sorts of horrific stories about, you know, what oftentimes happens to these people. But it's a tremendous, tremendous number. And of the 143 million orphans in the world today, only about 250 of those children are going to be adopted on an annual basis. So this isn't about finding a home for 143 million people. This is about providing provisions for the folks that are really tasked with taking care of them.
You said 250.
250,000.
250,000 of the 143 million.
Yes, yes.
How, when you hear that number, 143 million, and you think about Sudan and Rwanda, where
yes.
people or children are being orphaned daily or
yes.
have been, how do you, it's amazing that you're not intimidated by that number.
Oh, it's an incredibly intimidating number. And I think for the longest time, well-meaning people, even like our own family, you know, are so intimidated. You don't think you can make a difference. And so you write your check on a monthly basis to sponsor an orphan or sponsor an organization, and you don't really feel like you're able to move the needle much. And I think that is the biggest opportunity for us in what we're trying to do. We're not gonna solve this problem, certainly. We think, though, that by joining with corporate America that has, you know, so much to gain by creating increased stability in some of these markets, we think we can put a big dent in it. Again, we're not going to make the orphan, you know, problem, if you will, go away. We're not trying to necessarily find homes for 143 million children, but what we think we can do is improve their quality of life and give them a better shot as adults.
Now, you're trying to get 10,000 likes on Facebook. And why that number? Why Facebook?
So it's a fairly I'll be quick to admit this. It's a fairly random goal. You know, we were just sitting around thinking, you know, before we start taking meetings with some of these big companies, it would be great if we could show that the public cares, that this is something that's relevant, that resonates, and if we could have 10,000 friends, if you will, come with us into those first meetings and show these big companies that this is different, it's unique, and a lot of people are excited and are joining with us in a sense. And so we did. We set out a goal to have 1,000 likes by Thanksgiving and 10,000 likes by the end of the year. And we've a long ways to go, but I think we'll hit it.
Do you have an idea of where you would want to be in a year, two, five?
I think we've got some pretty ambitious goals that again would be pretty random at this point. I mean, one of the things that we've decided to do is like I mentioned before, instead of being random and just throwing money at specific projects, what we want to do is find families like the Morrises that say, we've got this tremendous burden for the orphans in a particular country. And so as our country directors, the Morris family living in Ecuador will be advocating in a sense. They'll be getting to know the orphan problem, again, firsthand, up close and personal. They'll get to know the government officials. They get to know the business community. They get to know the folks that are running these orphanages. And then they will be coming back to our organization and advocating in a sense and saying, you know, we need this much money to increase capacity in Riobamba. We need this much money to take care of a dilapidated facility here. And we need this much money to build a new structure in a new city. And our hope is that in a relatively short period of time that we would have a family step forward and say, you know what, we've got such a tremendous burden for the orphan problem in China or in Kenya or in Haiti. And we would have, you know, several families advocating for the orphans in those individual markets. And we would be coming together and figuring out a way to raise money to address those specific problems.
I love that. Advocates for these orphanages from around the world.
I think that's what it's going to take. It's going to take somebody that it's more than and I don't want to take anything away from the great families that are writing checks every month and not 100% sure what's being done with that money, because we've done it for 20 years, my wife and I. But I think that you take it to another level when you've got families that are waking up every morning thinking about those orphans and what can be done to make their lives better.
Matt, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Matt Pfeiffer is the executive director of Global Orphan Initiative and was in our studio earlier this month. You can learn more at the website globalorphaninitiative.com. The organization is also trying to reach 10,000 likes at its Facebook page by the end of this year, and this morning was nearing the 1,000 mark. And ahead on Ozarks, Roby Brock from Talk Business has the week's business and political news wrapped up in one efficient report. And later, how pirates changed the world. Chris Lane teaches history at Tulane University and recently delivered a guest lecture at the University of Arkansas. During his visit, he also talked with us about pirates, the colonization of the Americas, and much more. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Hello, this is Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz, every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On this week's program, we'll hear music from Peter Erskine, Ray Anderson, Ray Charles, and Betty Carter. We'll also hear from Larry Coryell and Freddie Hubbard, this and much more. That's Friday night on Shades of Jazz, beginning at 10 p.m.
Arvest made a major acquisition last week. Casinos in Arkansas report that they continue to rake in the cash. And the conversation over the future of Arkansas's health insurance options has a new wrinkle. Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business has his Monday wrap-up of the week's business and political news.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Arvest Bank announced on Thursday it's entered into an agreement with the Bank of America Corporation to purchase 29 locations and most deposit accounts and loans associated with those locations. 9 of the locations are in Arkansas. The purchase is subject to regulatory approvals, which are expected in the first quarter of next year. Terms of the transaction were not disclosed. The agreement includes 9 branches in Arkansas in Harrison, Hot Springs, Hot Springs Village, Mountain Home, and Russellville. Arkansas Children's Hospital announced that CEO Dr. Jonathan Bates will retire on June 30th of 2013. His 2 decades at the helm will make him the second longest serving CEO in the hospital's history. The Children's Hospital Board also announced it will create the Jonathan Bates Center for Patient and Professional Advocacy. So far, $3 million in funding has been dedicated to help establish the Policy Center. In an effort to capitalize on its nationally known name and to reposition its interest in regional job growth, the Garland County Economic Development Corporation's changed its name to the Hot Springs Metro Partnership. The group unveiled a new website, growhotsprings.com, aimed at showcasing the area's amenities and economic advantages. The name Hot Springs Metro Partnership was chosen because it better reflects the region outside of Arkansas. The group's research had shown that many people did not know where Garland County was, but they were familiar with Hot Springs. With 1 month to go, casino-style gambling at Arkansas's 2 racetracks is poised to top $2.5 billion for the full year. According to the latest statistics released by the Arkansas Racing Commission, casinos in Hot Springs-based Oaklawn and West Memphis-based Southland have totaled $2.485 billion in electronic games of skill from January through November. That is up 39% from the previous year. The Delta Regional Authority will invest nearly $200,000 into the El Dorado incubator environment known as Edie's Village to provide support for entrepreneurs across parts of South and Southeast Arkansas. Contributors to the partnership include South Arkansas's Community College, the Arkansas Women's Business Center, and Windrock International. The investment will develop student-run businesses, launch retail space for local entrepreneurs, and provide one-on-one business development and product marketing counseling for participating entrepreneurs. Brian Harson, a 13-year veteran of the coaching ranks, has been named as the head football coach at Arkansas State University. He replaces Gus Malzahn, who took the head coaching job at Auburn. And in politics, the debate over whether Arkansas will have a state-run health insurance exchange, a federal exchange, or a hybrid may be moot for now. Governor Mike Beebe told reporters this week that Arkansas will opt into a partnership with the federal government to implement a health insurance exchange, which is part of the Federal Affordable Care Act. The health care reform law calls on states to have insurance exchanges where qualified individuals and businesses can shop for health insurance options. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
It's Monday, December 17th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
If you need a little break from the Christmas thing, go to Crystal Bridges at 1 and check out a lecture called Navigating the Architecture of Moshe Safdie. You've heard about him and heard about him. He's the architect who designed Crystal Bridges and lots of other things. And a couple of staff folks from the museum will talk about why it's important and how to understand how cool it is. The talk will take place in the center of the early 20th century art gallery, and it's free. And from 4 to 7 tonight, back to the Christmas thing, you can go to Lawrence Plaza in Bentonville and get your photo taken with Santa. He's everywhere.
He is everywhere. Busy man. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
In just a moment on Ozarks, Albert King is the subject of this week's edition of Arkansongs. And later, Chris Lane is a preeminent historian when it comes to the colonization of Latin America. He's also a professor at Tulane University and recently delivered a guest lecture on the University of Arkansas campus. During his visit, he came here as well for a conversation. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. The Good Shepherd Humane Society invites you to visit their holiday wish tree. Select an angel card that will benefit stray, abandoned, and neglected animals in Carroll County. The holiday wish trees are in the front room of each doggy thrift store. For more information about the holiday wish tree or about how you can help the Good Shepherd Humane Society by volunteering, 253-9188. KUAF and the Fort Smith Chorale will present an a cappella Christmas Thursday morning at 11. The concert was recorded live November 29th in Fort Smith and will bring in the Christmas season with many of your favorite carols, including Good King Wenceslas, Deck the Halls, We Three Kings, and more. An a cappella Christmas from the Fort Smith Chorale Thursday morning at 11 on KUAF 91.3 FM. And KUAF would like to say thank you to our listeners. Your financial support has made 2012 a great year. Still time to make your tax-deductible gift to KUAF this year. You can donate online at supportkuaf.com. Thank you and happy holidays.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Hanging on when you belong to someone else. Can't control the feeling, 'cause after all I didn't make myself. Yeah.
Albert King is the father of modern blues guitar and the most influential and imitated of post-World War II blues guitarists. King was born Albert Nelson on April 25, 1923 in Indianola, Mississippi. His father, Will, played guitar. In the early 1930s, he moved the Nelson family to East Arkansas, first Forest City in St. Francis County, and then Osceola in Mississippi County. It was during Albert King's decade at Stax Records of Memphis, Tennessee, that King at long last emerged as a giant in his field. The Stax House Band, Booker T and the MGs with the Memphis Horns, including Wayne Jackson of West Memphis, gave King a tightly arranged modern sound. During the Summer of Love in August 1967, Albert King's Born Under a Bad Sign album was released. The landmark album is credited with not only modernizing, but revolutionizing the moribund blues world. Further, it strongly influenced the emerging British invasion guitar work of Keith Richards, Jimmy Page, and others, especially Eric Clapton. Clapton and his band The Cream recorded their version of Born Under a Bad Sign for their album Wheels of Fire the month the Albert King album was released. Jimi Hendrix and Rita Coolidge were among the others who subsequently recorded the song.
Born under a bad sign. Why?
Likewise, Led Zeppelin appropriated part of Albert King's still new song, The Hunter, into the closer of its debut album, but Led Zeppelin chose not to share credit. Ike and Tina Turner also had a hit with The Hunter, and it's been recorded by artists from Coco Taylor to Danzig. In 1971, John Mayall, considered the father of the English blues rock scene, a scene inspired in part by Albert King himself, produced King on an album for Stax. Stateside, the rock and roll world fell for Albert King as well, and the middle-aged Arkansasian found himself playing rock concerts and entrenched in the counterculture.
How long have I got to wait for you to stop lying to me? How long have I got to wait for you to stop lying to me? It's gonna be some changes made. Woman, you just wait and see.
Meanwhile, Albert King kept up his end as a blues man for a new era. In 1969, Albert King performed with the St. Louis Symphony. In 1970, King recorded a tribute album to Elvis Presley, and in 1971, recorded an album at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, mostly comprised of songs by producer Don Nix and a cover of Honky Tonk Woman. King incorporated funk and other sounds into his blues, recording with the Bar Kays, Isaac Hayes' band The Movement, and the Memphis Symphony Orchestra. One of King's oddest pairings was with Albert Brooks on Brooks' 1975 comedy album, A Star Is Bought, which was nominated for a Grammy and also featured the likes of Alice Cooper, Linda Ronstadt, and Harry Nilsson. By the 1980s, a new crop of blues-oriented guitar slingers had risen, most of them heavily influenced by King, with Stevie Ray Vaughan emerging as the most prominent, the most vocal, and the most obvious disciple of Albert King. In the rap world, Albert King's songs have been sampled by a wide range of rappers from the golden age of hip-hop through today. Public Enemy, Cypress Hill, Wu-Tang Clan, DMX, Pretty Lights, Biz Markie, Big Daddy Kane, and more. 2013 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee Albert King died December 21, 1992, at his home in Memphis, Tennessee, of a heart attack. King was buried in nearby Edmondson in southern Crittenden County, Arkansas. Here in its entirety is Arkansas Your Albert King, recorded in 1971 by John Mayall with Stop Lying. Stop Lying by influential East Arkansas blues guitar giant Albert King. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. The popular image of a pirate is often a swashbuckling, bearded character seeking riches at sea. Whether Errol Flynn or Johnny Depp, the pirate has been portrayed as an anti-hero with little regard to authority. Turns out, real pirates did operate outside, usually, the reach of governments. Chris Lane teaches history at Tulane University and is a preeminent historian when it comes to colonial Latin American history. He recently came to the University of Arkansas to deliver a guest lecture, and during his time here, he also came to our studio.
Piracy is as old as shipping, and the Greek word piratis is where we get pirate, and it essentially was a word for bandit as well, but it came to be attached to sea bandits, specifically over time. And certainly there was wealth traveling around the Mediterranean, wealth traveling across the Indian Ocean. But after the discovery of the Americas, or the encounter of the Americas with Europe and with Africa, the exploitation of mineral wealth was greatly expanded, so exponentially expanded. So the attraction for pirates became almost irresistible, I would say.
This exploration of this world that Europeans had not seen before, maybe literally an embarrassment of riches, right? I mean,
yes, I think it's fair to say that. I mean, indigenous folks used emeralds, they used gold, they used silver for ornamentation and for religious objects and so forth. Very few instances that we know of those items being gold or silver being used as currency, or of gemstones being used as currency. Certain shells, some types of beads like wampum in the Northeast, could be used as a sort of currency. But the monetized economies of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and of course China, India, these were economies that could absorb extraordinary amounts of gold and silver into their economies, and that was the windfall for the Spanish initially.
So this was just an explosion of currency.
Yes,
I mean this unbelievable addition of unknown amounts of gold and silver.
Yeah, it essentially overnight transformed a global economy that was predominantly an economy in kind. So where exchanges. For example, in China, tribute was paid in rice or in cloth or some other commodity that you could produce either in farming or at home. And taxes were very quickly shifted to money. So the silver economy became the kind of global standard. And troops also demanded to be paid in silver coin rather than in promissory notes or some other thing. So the expansion of the silver economy is also the expansion of gunpowder empires. We link these two things together, kind of a growth in global arms trade and in the really transformation of military operations worldwide.
Spain, then later Portugal,
yes,
start to benefit. And was there a papal decree that kind of halved up the, quote, New World?
Yes. It was formalized with the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. It was a papal decree that essentially gave everything east of a line running 370 leagues west of the Cape Verdes or the Canaries. There are two versions of this. But it essentially, from the mouth of the Amazon, if you ran a line south to the mouth of the River Plate near Buenos Aires, you'd have the line of Tordesillas. So Brazil fell within the Portuguese sphere. Everything to the east of that line was the Portuguese sphere of influence. And everything west of that fell to Spain. And the real dispute ended up being the Philippines, because the Spanish had a claim to the Philippines since they had sent an expedition there in the 1520s before the Portuguese had reached that site.
And it's Spain and Portugal mainly because they have the best navies and they have done the exploration?
It's a good question. This is an era before formal navies. These are essentially rather like early corsairing or pirate voyages. They're joint capital operations where a couple of wealthy merchants, perhaps, with some crown backing, maybe a bit of money put in by the crown. As in the case of the Columbus voyages, there was some royal investment, but that was quite rare. Ordinarily, these were private enterprises that had some sort of royal sanction or some royal license. And when these individuals went abroad, they would seek to, in the case of the Portuguese, try to get around the tip of Africa, knowing that they'd get a prize from the king when they got back. So the money going into it was rarely royal sponsorship in the direct sense, but there's a lot of after-the-fact recognition. So the empire is really not – both the Spanish and Portuguese empires, overseas empires, are really built by private enterprise with the crown coming in afterwards and formalizing the arrangement. So the conquistadors are very similar. They're self-financed, but they seek a monopoly license on trade or control of a given region after they prove to the king that they can pull off the big heist, as it were.
So I've got to imagine that the rest of Europe was not entirely pleased with this new land of riches being split between two countries.
Absolutely not. The French this is before the Protestant Reformation, so most everyone is at least claiming to be Catholic, but not wanting to trust the Pope on this one. He was
funny how that works when it comes to money, right?
He was a Spanish Pope, uh-huh. So he was likely to rule in their favor. So the King of France, Francis I, said something, or is said to have said something like, "Where was it in Adam's will that the Spanish and Portuguese got the world divided between them?" So the French are the first corsairs, actually, the French under Catholic sponsorship. But again, private enterprise, really, in small cities, Rouen, Bordeaux, La Rochelle, Dieppe, Nantes. Mariners, essentially, seafaring folk, start to prey on vessels coming back from the Americas. And Columbus, on I think his third voyage, is already facing pirates and their French corsairs. That's corsairing is one way of showing your disinterest in the Pope's decree.
So would there be – were there strategies for the pirates, the corsairs, to
yes.
intercept?
Their main aim, of course, is to go after liquid treasure. So ideally, they would like to capture gold, silver, gemstones, things that they could dispose of quickly. But in lieu of that, they would capture slave ships. They would capture vessels carrying dyewood, vessels carrying sugar or cloth or – in rare instances, ransomable personages. But that was really the strategy of the corsairs of North Africa. And Mediterranean corsairing in this period, piracy broadly speaking, but the term corsair is the contemporary one. At that time, people said, oh, he's a corsair. Corsario, the Spanish would say. And corso was the kind of war of corsairing. And that was in the Mediterranean, certainly people tried to capture vessels with treasure aboard, but more often they would capture people that could be held for ransom. And a way to avoid getting caught would be to pay an extortion fee in advance. So a kind of mafia-like operation where you pay the corsairs of Algiers.
Protection.
Yes, exactly. So the corsairing in the Mediterranean is an extortion and kidnapping racket. And that's how it operated, essentially. And those who were captured and not ransomed could be made galley slaves. So the vessels themselves would be powered by enslaved captives from abroad. The Atlantic piracy that develops is really much more of an open sea, long distance focus on liquid capital, really grabbing those treasure ships or ships that might – or towns that could be ransomed. So what often the French corsairs would do, if they couldn't capture a ship coming back from Spain with treasure aboard – because they learned quickly to travel in convoys. So the Spanish,
right.
You know, they get wise. They realize if we travel in convoys and we arm several of those vessels, then it'll be harder for these corsairs to capture us unless they can put together a fleet. And so what the corsairs would do is try to catch straggling ships maybe going through the Florida Straits. And in lieu of that, they would go to Havana or Cartagena, which in this era were very small towns. They weren't big cities yet, and hold the town for ransom, essentially pull up alongside the town or come into the bay and say, we're going to blast the town hall unless you give us some money. So they they forced the Spanish to wall and close those towns, and even to abandon quite a few towns that couldn't be adequately defended. The next bunch of pirates that come along are the Elizabethan English pirates. And there's an ongoing war between Spain and England, but even during peacetime, corsairing continues. So Francis Drake is probably the most famous of the corsairs of that period. And he's certainly a Protestant who sees no love for Catholic Spain. But he begins as a slave trader. He and a cousin, John Hawkins, they're West Country Englishmen who are putting together these corsairing voyages in the English Channel, but they see a possibility to penetrate the Spanish-American slave trade. So they go – this is something that the Portuguese by this time had taken over. They go into West Africa and actually capture Africans from villages and put them aboard their ships and take them to the coast of Venezuela and what's today Colombia and try to force local people to buy the slaves. Now, locals – know that they're not supposed to purchase slaves from Englishmen because that's contraband, that the contract is held by the Portuguese, and slaves are supposed to be sold only in official ports of entry and so forth. But Drake and his companions do manage to sell slaves in a couple of voyages in the 1560s. They do quickly discover that you can't go back to the same villages in Africa and capture people. They're ready for you the next time. So
you have to find new places.
In what they discover is that the Portuguese had already figured out that you need to trade for captives taken in wars in the interior, try to make friends with people in one place and say, are there enemies of yours that have produced captives? But that transformation in slave trading is pretty quick. The Elizabethan corsairs, Drake and Hawkins, come back in 1568, and the Spanish are ready for them in the Caribbean. They essentially say, no, you can't sell any of those slaves. And the colonists say, no, we can't purchase any of those slaves or we'll lose our heads. And so many of the slaves suffer. Many of them die. Ultimately, the ships try to exit the Gulf of Mexico and get caught in a storm, a nor'easter, that pushes them back into the Gulf. And they stop at Veracruz, the port of Mexico, on the Atlantic side. And the old law of the sea is if you have a tattered ship and you've suffered in wrecks and so forth, or you're in danger of losing all hands, that even an enemy port should give you a chance to refit your ships and be on your way. So they were taking advantage of that law, and they were given a time to try to fix their vessels. While they were there, the new viceroy of Mexico arrived with a fleet and was outraged that pirates were refitting ships. As far as he could see, the English contraband traders, who also were known for their pirate activity, that they were refitting in his port. So he and his vessels fired on the English, who then tried to escape, and most of the vessels were destroyed. But Drake and Hawkins did make it back to England separately, limping back.
Right.
But angry as hell. They were extremely upset, and Drake then basically devoted the rest of his life to singeing the King of Spain's beard, as he put it.
The idea many of us have about pirates, if we heard that term, are these sort of free agents who are only in it for themselves, to get rich themselves. But many of the corsairs had official or unofficial backing, right?
Yes. Yeah. The definition of a corsair, the term later becomes privateer. So in the 18th century, you hear the word privateer. All that means is that you're engaging in an act of piratical seizure of somebody, some private person's goods or a vessel at sea, but you're doing it with a license, a letter of marque and reprisal. So the kind of the medieval law of the sea was no one really can control the sea. No one can claim sovereignty over the sea. So at sea, it's catch as catch can. So what's best is to have a kind of floating castle with high walls on it and cannons bristling all around to show that you can't be easily taken. But it's this sort of castle at sea mentality, my castle against your castle. And if you fall to mine, well, that's just too bad. But if that should happen and I survive, then I should seek from my monarch or my sovereign a letter of mark and reprisal so that next time I go out, if I see a ship flying the same flag as the one that had taken mine, that's fair game for me. So mark and it's got an eye for an eye sort of understanding. Now, the Spanish and Portuguese, after the Treaty of Tordesillas, tried to argue that, no, these are our waterways. We're essentially establishing seaways in which it's really only legal for us to sail and trade and so forth. And other Europeans challenging that said, no, that's hooey. And in wars between these states, letters of mark and reprisal just flew.
Finally, how did your interest in this period of history begin?
I grew up in Colorado. And
there's going to be more.
Okay. I was always interested, though, in the Spanish conquistadors and the search through the Southwest for the seven cities of Cibola and all of those stories. That was, to me, the most exciting thing about the western part of the United States. Like Colorado means red, you know, right, or reddish color or something like that. So the notion of that land having some romantic treasure hunters in its past got me excited, and I continued to move south, first to Mexico and then to the Andes and more recently to Brazil and Argentina.
And still, now you're at Tulane, New Orleans, not a bad place.
This is a great place to be a historian of Latin America. That's absolutely true. It had its Spanish period and its French period, and it's still very exciting.
Is there any where people can go on the web to find out more about your work? Or
I'm on the Tulane University website, both under Latin American Studies and under History.
Chris Lane, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Kyle.
Chris Lane is a professor at Tulane University and recently delivered a guest lecture at the University of Arkansas, sponsored by the African and African American Studies, the History Department, Latin American Studies, the Multicultural Center, and Phi Alpha Theta, all at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Gentry. Big holiday tradition at KUAF, the Jonathan Winters A Christmas Carol, returns this year. It's a public radio tradition, not just at KUAF. It's hosted by NPR's Susan Stamberg. The master comedian Jonathan Winters presents a truly distinctive reading of Dickens' holiday classic with a special performing edition prepared by Dickens for the presentations that Charles Dickens himself did. It also features Mimi Kennedy. It's from NPR and KCRW. A Jonathan Winters Christmas Carol returns to the KUAF airwaves on the 24th. That's a week from today, Christmas Eve Day at 11 that morning. A week from today at 11 a.m. Bentonville High School's Amnesty International Group is organizing a community donation event at Bentonville High School for December 20th and 21st. That's Thursday and Friday. You can donate non-perishable foods, coats, blankets, scarves, and other necessities for the cold weather. You can donate at 1801 Southeast J Street in Bentonville. And the Hobbs Conservation Area, offering a unique hands-on astronomy workshop Friday night beginning at 6:30 at the Parks Visitor Center on Highway 12, just east of the Highway 12 War Eagle Road intersection. Participants will build their own full-scale working model of the telescope used by Galileo about 400 years ago. Easy-to-understand workshop, they promise. It'll be taught by Stuart Riley, a Ph.D. of Physics in Astronomy. For cost and a list of needed items, 789-5000. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large featuring Ryan Fort, University of Arkansas graduate, Rogers native. Now he lives in Colorado, but he was back for the holidays and talking about his music, including his brand new CD. Ryan Fort and much more on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large on KUAF. You can listen to this show or any show, again, by the way, online at ozarksatlarge.com. Have a pleasant Monday.